Hello and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast with me, Ariane Morrissey. This week, I'm pleased to welcome the Secretary General of the International Maritime Organization, Arsenio Dominguez, as the world has begun to digest the many ramifications of the first greenhouse gas pricing mechanism for international shipping, which was approved by IMO member states in a rare vote at MEPC 83 in April. We'll, of course, look back at what was a very eventful week at the IMO's London headquarters, but perhaps most importantly, we'll look ahead to the next steps, the planned adoption of the measures, which is scheduled for October, and what this new GHG pricing mechanism will change in practice for the maritime industry. Welcome to the podcast, Secretary General.
Thank you. A pleasure being here with you.
So when I was speaking with delegates immediately after the vote, it was quite striking to hear many of them say that the agreement wasn't what they wanted initially, but it was something that most of them could live with. So I wondered, is this also your assessment? And is this good enough for something that's as important as the first GHG pricing mechanism for shipping?
I think the answer is basically in the question that you just made, and is the first pricing mechanism that exists out there, a mandatory pricing mechanism. If we look into all the fragmentation that exists in the world right now, this is an immense achievement for IMO and, of course, for the United Nations family. It takes us one step further into achieving that goal that we set up in the 2023 GHG IMO strategy of decarbonizing the sector by around 2050. There are several situations, there's several opinions, different points of view that we have to address. And of course, it's always going to be difficult to meet everybody's expectations, but it's focusing on the progress, on the positives of this outcome, and that all the work that we're going to build from this onwards, together with the decisions that we've been taking since 2011 to decarbonize and enhance the efficiency of the sector. Put all that together, and this is why this is a great outcome, not just for IMO, but the signal for the rest of the world as well.
And one of the main criticisms, and you've alluded to it just now, and that was a criticism including from academics that modelled the impact of the new framework, is that the measures are unlikely to achieve the IMO's own GHG emission target for 2030. So do you believe that there's a credibility issue, or do you think it was better to have perhaps a slightly weaker compromise than having no deal at all?
No, there's no credibility issue. IMO demonstrates day in, day out, the importance of its work, how it brings the parties together and how we know how to make progress. There are different models out there. I am aware of that. Everybody has the right to an opinion. And I also respect all that. But we should not be looking at this in isolation. This is not just the measures that we have approved just a couple of weeks ago and that will be adopted in October this year that is going to take us to decarbonizing the sector. We need to look back at the energy efficiency design index, at the management plan, the efficiency management plan that we have, the carbon intensity indicator, all the data collection systems that we have that allow us to review also our measures. And we have already put in place a revision of the strategy every 5 years. We have the targets for 2030, then 2040, and of course, the final by around 2050. So we shouldn't be looking in isolation to this. I am convinced that with all the steps that we have taken before, in this step in particular, we are on track to meet first 2030, and then, of course, continue to work towards 2040 and 2050.
And the fact that there was a vote to approve the measure at MEPC 83 was actually quite rare. And it shows in a way how deep divisions are between member states. So do you believe that there is a risk of the measures not being adopted in October?
I wouldn't put it as divisions. It's difference of opinions within the membership. We all agree to decarbonize in the sector, is stated in the strategy. Is how to get there. And of course, there's several analyses that we have taken into account and that we have carried out, the impact assessment on the fleet, on the member states, the different sectors within shipping as well. And there's more work to do. And for us now is to start gathering information, taking the next steps and planning in how to address those concerns. Because the work is not just taking a decision now and then pausing everything else. No, we always listened to the whole debate. Yes, there was a vote. Still, we work on consensus, and I expect a similar result, hopefully on the same consensus basis, towards October. And from then on, the next steps, because we don't finish then. This is a marathon. This is not a sprint race.
And where will you be focusing your energies between now and October? Because on the last day of NEPC 83, you mentioned that your priority would be to try and bring people on board this agreement. So I wondered who you're going to want to speak to as a priority, those that abstained, those that voted no, and is it your aim to try and obtain a consensus rather than a vote in October?
I work with this in the same way that I work with any other decision at IMO. I engage everyone and I will reach out to as many as possible. Of course, that addressing the concern of those that voted no or against is one of those key priorities as well, because it is important to demonstrate that we are listening, that this is not just isolating or dividing. And even though it was a vote, it doesn't mean that it creates a division. It just demonstrates that we have more work to do in order to gather the parties together and seek this consensus that we always have. And we never stop. Apart from that, it's the preparation for the next session, the additional analysis that we need to put in place, the planning for all the guidelines and the work plan that is going to lead us to the entry into force of these amendments in 2027. We always knew that it was in the member states, that this was a very challenging and ambitious plan. And that's how we are dealing with it, in a very structural manner. But the conversations continue. The meeting probably closed a couple of weeks ago, but our engagement never stops.
And in your engagement or in your discussions with those member states that perhaps had concerns or were disappointed with the outcome, what can you actually offer them, given that the text itself is not going to change very much between now and October?
It's how we're going to address those concerns. This particular, if we look at one, which was the food security, is how we make sure that as we roll out this engagement, all the analysis and the assessment is always put in place. So by the time that we also provide the additional support, including any financial support for this transition, is how we cater and address any negative impact that come from the different member states. Tapping on the opportunities. Just as there are challenges, there will always be areas where the member states will benefit from it. Look at certain regions, particularly the Global South, where the raw materials or the sources of renewable energies are in abundance and are required for others. So all this is part of that interaction that we put in place to highlight the positives as well as the challenges and how one also supports the other, and not to look at them as just one part of the action, but ignoring the rest.
And one member state at NEPC 83 raised a lot of media attention. I'm talking about the United States. So I wondered, what's going to be your approach with the United States between now and October? Are you going to try to seek a rapprochement?
There's no difference. For me, I have 176 member states to look after. The United States is one of those member states. I respect all the decisions and the opinions of the member states. It's not for us to criticize or to express a specific point of view, but to allow this engagement and to look for ways to continue to find those engagements. I'm always open to conversations and negotiations, and I know that they are as well. There are several meetings that we have in the organization. And it's looking again towards the future, what else we need to do as an organization and all the member states to enhance that engagement.
And some important practical details, including the life cycle assessment of that GHG intensity of fuels, also how the revenues collected by the GHG pricing mechanism will be distributed. A lot of this was left to separate guidelines. So how will those guidelines be developed, and when will the industry know what those details will look like?
Well, the guidelines, we start on the plan already to outline all the guidelines that we need to develop and put in place before the entry into force of the amendments. We'll start doing some of the groundwork. The members, we will publish that document ahead of the next extraordinary session, member states will start working on it. There has been an agreement already to have an intersessional meeting right after the extraordinary session in October in order to progress this work. This is nothing new for us, nothing that we haven't done before. We will establish, of course, correspondence group of experts that would allow us to progress the assistance from the Secretariat. And those discussions will take place. When it comes to distribution of funds, as I've always said, it's not just creating anything new. We also will learn and engage with others that can provide us advice, experience, and expertise for us to have all the pillars in place by the time that the amendments enter into force. And the industry is always part of all these negotiations and discussions that I am on. So as much as they know exactly what the amendments look like, they're all sort of aware and engaged in this development. My call is for them to start taking the actions well in advance.
And what timeline are you working towards with regards to these guidelines? Because when you speak to people in the industry, especially potential producers of alternative fuels for shipping, I think they're wanting to hear more clarity about the details that will be contained in those guidelines. So what's the timeline?
That's always happened. The more information we provide, the more requests that we get for additional guidance and clarification, but that's part of our process. We have already the life cycle assessment experts group that has been working for a couple of years now and is providing their reports to the Marine Environment Protection Committee. We have a timeline. Of course, the amendments will enter into force in 2027. And by then, we will need all the information in place with the guidelines for the implementation of the fund, as well as the calculations, etc. We will make this progress and the documents will be released as soon as they are ready. And we went through something similar in relation to the IMO 2020. I know that it's not at the same level, but it's the same experience where actions were taken ahead, not just by the industry, but by other sectors, including the energy sector, in providing those new fuels, low sulfur fuels that were required. So it's the same thing now. There's a lot of areas for engagements and improvements when it comes to research and development. We are working since this year in the training requirements for the usage of these alternative fuels, the training of the seafarers as well. So this is an ongoing aspect. Our subcommittees in dangerous goods and cargoes have been working on the safety aspects of these fuels for a few years as well. So there's nothing new there that we haven't worked on. And we also need to remember that some of these fuels, we actually have transported them as cargo. So we're not starting from scratch. It is the continuous engagement, the participation of all the sectors as well to carry out and engage in this research and development, share the information with us, member states, NGOs, IGOs, including the industry, because that will be the proactivity that will allow us also to disseminate all this knowledge for everyone to be part of this game.
So what is your message for people in the maritime industry today? I mean, ship owners, operators, fuel producers, what should they be doing right now as a result of the measures being approved by MEPC 83?
I'll use a phrase that is a very UN phrase that I don't like to use loosely, but is don't be left behind. The information is out there. It is very clear where we're going after the approval of these amendments. The actions that you need to take to be proactive, preparing with all the knowledge that is being gathered with activities and projects like the Green Maritime Corridors. And it's now the time to start creating the projections, because I know that this is a business into where your investments are going, what your trading routes are, what are the alternative fuels that you will be engaging with, what additional information you will be requesting for IMO. But it's not time to be passive anymore. This is now time for action. We provided that time frame into the decarbonization in 2023. We now have the guidelines on when it comes to the fuel standard, as well as the pricing mechanism that is coming into place, the guidelines that we are going to develop. We started already with the training requirements. So it's now time to act.
And to finish, if the measures are formally adopted in the autumn, shipping...
The measure will be formally adopted in August, in the autumn.
So then shipping would become the first industry to have a global price on carbon. So why is multilateralism, which is having a struggle in other forums still alive at the IMO? And are there any lessons that you could offer to other industries that perhaps would want to go down a similar route to try and adopt global regulation on greenhouse gas emissions?
Absolutely. It's difficult to go beyond because I don't want to compare like for like. But I'm always happy to share, you know, the experience that we had at IMO in relation to bringing the parties together. And there's a lot of listening that we do addressing concerns. And this is understanding that as much as we all are very ambitious and we share those goals, there are differences. Not all the countries are at the same level when it comes to responding to the challenges, and that some need more assistance than others. And this is something that IMO has been very good at, carrying out those analyses, those impact assessments, listening to the member states, put actions when it comes to technical cooperation, projects, capacity building, to demonstrate that we care. But it also demonstrates that as we listen to each other, we understand, we also create that benchmark for multilateralism to regulate what is a global industry and that benefits everyone around the world, and that divisions and fragmentations will create an increased imbalance when it comes to the benefits and the needs that we all have from shipping, and that when there's so many divisions around the world, bringing the parties together in order to focus on solutions immediately demonstrates that multilateralism is the way forward.
And because we talk about lessons, is there anything that you wish you'd done differently throughout these discussions leading up to that GHG pricing mechanism being approved?
I know I focus on the positives, which is where we are right now and what comes next. Looking at the back for me, it's mostly on the concerns that are there. They were very well-known concerns. That's very little that is new to me, if you ask me directly. But it is keeping that demonstration that we are listening, that we're going to address those concerns. What I will do, I'm always critical to myself. So it's did I fail at any engagement? I don't think I did. But I still need to look for ways to enhance that collectivity approach, that transparency, that interaction with everyone, and demonstrate that as we work together is as one, and that whenever all this thing that the fragmentations are IMO, it's just a difference of opinion, but we always focus on what are the next steps that will allow us to continue to move forward in a way that demonstrates our responsibility towards the sector, towards the people that benefit and needs the sector, as well as the future generations.
And what do you think is going to be your main challenge between now and the next steps that are coming up?
Oh, all the other work that has to happen at IMO as well beyond GHG discussions. We have the work of the organization doesn't stop. And for as much as we're putting a lot of efforts into GHG, there are some other topics that I have to focus on as well. It doesn't mean that GHG is not important, but it's time now for me to also pay attention to the rest of the important work of this organization ahead of October, because let's face it, MEPC doesn't make decisions on its own. There's several other bodies that are also working on different steps that will make possible the whole achievement of the GHG 2023 strategy.
Arsenio Dominguez, thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.